Vegas Bad Boy of Podcasting is an entertainment-based program. The opinions shared are that of the host and their guests. Some celebrity voices are impersonated and usually not well. This program is not intended for kids and certain adults. Listener's discretion is advised. You have been warned. Now let's get ready to podcast. This is a special edition with our guest, Scott Norton.
Welcome to another edition of Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. I'm your host, DJ Impact, and I got some of the bad boys here with me today. King Lucky, how are you?
I'm doing well, brother. I'm excited. Good interview here.
Awesome, awesome. Matt Michaels.
I'm good, and I'm feeling like it's a flash coming.
As you should. That means we have a special guest on the line. You've seen him in New Japan, Pro Wrestling, WCW, and WWF. Back in the 90s, and he got back in New Japan in the early 2000s. But most importantly, he's an author on his official autobiography titled Strong Style. And you can buy that right now at scottflashnorton.com. So Vegas Bad Boys, welcome Scott Norton.
All right.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Let's jump into the book right away and, just get it out there. You definitely have been getting good feedback. What brought this about? Why did you think it's time to tell the story?
Well, it's something that I really didn't plan on doing early in my career or during my career. And then NWO Sting, Jeff Farmer, and my wife Tammy kept hammering me about doing a book. You know, Tammy had come on tour with me over in Japan, and I brought her to Japan me quite a few times, 25 times.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, and me and Jeff did so many tours together, you know, and he became one of my best friends in the business and in life. And, they just kept on me, you know, and I kind of started thinking, you know, and they started telling about this story here and this, you know, my weightlift and my arm wrestling and, you know, my success in professional wrestling and, you know, half the crazy stuff I did as a young guy growing up. And, so, you know, we went for it. It's turned out to be just awesome.
And if I'm correct, the co-author, who helped you on this book, he was a fan of yours, right?
Yeah, still is. I mean, he's him and his grandfather used to watch New Japan Wrestling. He's watched pretty much every match I've ever had.
Wow.
And his grandfather's favorite wrestler of all, you know, out of everybody. I guess he liked, you know, the Japanese strong style and, you know, the style that worked over there. And Adam Randis is his name, and he's just done a phenomenal job. And it's took a while, and it's not easy to do. Put it this way, he knew so much about me and my career that he pulled things out of my head that I forgot all about.
Wow!
and so, you know, and that's fortunate, especially when he's at that talented of a writer. So it really worked out. And I'm really grateful. And Adam just, you know, he knocked it out of the park. And he's taken the story and, you know, it's a dream come true kind of a deal, you know. I mean, it's pretty neat. And it's, the feedback I'm getting from friends and the fans is just outstanding. And I've had one negative comment. My wife got a little... She said I dropped a few F-bombs in there, but that was other than that.
Well, you're on the right show for that, then.
Oh, good.
Yeah, pardon me? You're on the right show for that. You can drop as many F-bombs here as...
Maybe I did. Maybe I didn't realize that, maybe I did, but that's all right. It's a great book. It's a great read. And it's been going great, so... I'm really excited about it moving forward.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome. And taking it back, you know, how did you started as an arm wrestler and you had a pretty extensive career there. tell us a little bit about how that came about. And, you know, there's a movie that you got attached to by being such a successful arm wrestler.
Well, you see, in the story, my arm wrestling career, leading my professional wrestling career, the story, it's actually linked to a professional wrestler back from seventh grade.
Wow.
Me and Rick Rude went to junior high school together.
Wow. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, me and Rick were really, really close friends. And Rick was a hell of an arm wrestler. And I mean a really good arm wrestler. And, you know, as well as I was. And he and I would arm wrestle for ice cream sandwiches in the lunchroom. In seventh grade. And then all the other guys, you know, and we ended up beating. I was bigger than Rick, and I got him.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was a whole 100 pounds. As professionals, I was 100 pounds heavier than he was. And, you know, back then, I was considered, you know, the gap was always kind of there. But, you know, we beat everybody. You know, we beat all the eighth graders, ninth graders, and Rick's the most stubborn guy in the world. I mean, when it comes to food, he didn't like giving none of that up.
Sounds just like me. Wars, man.
So anyways, you know, that led up through high school. And, you know, I was really, really good. I'd arm wrestle the guys on my dad's concrete crew. That's what I grew up doing as a, you know, I was doing concrete work with my dad when I was 12 years old. So, and I beat all the guys on his crew. And, you know, as I got a little older, 15, 16 years old. And then this big tournament came up in a bar downtown Minneapolis on Hennepin at Moby Dick's. And that's back when the drinking age was 21.
Right. And Moby Dick's, was Moby Dick's the bar that the Road Warriors bounced at?
No, but they did some damage here. it was a rough joint. There's a bar right across the street from it, the Roaring Twenties, where Hawk was a legend.
Oh, wow.
One of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyways, I went to that tournament and I snuck in. I didn't bring no friends with me because I knew, you know, we couldn't all get in there, and they let me in. You know, they thought I was old enough. And, so I went in this tournament. There's a lot of big guys in this tournament, and there's a bouncer named Clarence Kramer. He's a big, tough, badass guy, mighty of a Billy Jack kind of a guy.
Okay.
You know, with the jean jacket and the jeans and the cowboy boots, and he's just Jack. And he was a great guy, but I ended up just mowing right through the tournament. So
wow.
That's where it started, because after that, the people that put that tournament on told me I need to go to the state championship, which was about a month later.
Wow.
I went to the state championship, and I won that. Then there was the Upper Midwest Championships in August at State Fair, and I absolutely just blew that thing up. It was a two-day thing. It was still one of the best tournaments I've ever wrestled, as far as how many competitors there were. It was a two-day tournament, and how big there were just giant farm boys from everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just awesome. And I blew right through that. So then they talked me into going to Las Vegas for the World Championships. And so I'm 18 years old, and I said, well, nobody stopped me yet. I got my ass kicked. I went 0-2, and man, I learned. I said, so anyway, that's where it started, and I loved it. I was really good at it, which is, helps you love something. I really enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed training for it. I took it to, all the way to the top there. So that was awesome. I loved it.
Really quick on that, is that the arm wrestling community, is it kind of like the wrestling community itself, where, you start doing the different tournaments You start getting a little bit of a name for yourself, and then everyone kind of passes word of mouth, you know, hey, did you hear about Scott Norton? Is that kind of how you build up the reputation in doing the tournaments? And do you still talk to anyone? Are you still, I know that competitively you're not involved, but do you still have ties to professional arm wrestling?
Not as much as I should have. I got to know Devin Larratz. He's the world arm wrestling champion right now. He's absolutely amazing. And he actually did a blurb for my book, and I've had some chats with him. It's been really cool. I've done some podcasts, but the arm wrestling world is, of course, every time some guy comes out that's new, there's a big buzz. This guy from Minneapolis is just killing everybody. And, and when I went down to Vegas the first time, at no time before then was I ever in a room where I was intimidated. Even at 18, I just thought that my dad brought us up pretty strong, pretty hard. But when I got there, it was different, to say the least. These guys were so serious, and it was so, it's like I hit the rookie wall, or and they were cool as hell after the tournament. I mean, they nobody talked to me until after I got beat. then everybody's your best friend.
Right.
Afterwards, I worked on the table with a bunch of the guys and got to know Virgil Arcero, George Hood, and Bob Olson. And they're all kind of, it's the first time I've ever worked on when I arm wrestled before they started, it was ready to go, and there was no pressure. But in the world championships, there's all kinds of back pressure, which means you're pulling the arm towards you. And I've never experienced that yet. And I mean, these guys, their backload was just freaking crazy.
Wow.
And I just didn't know how to handle it, and they just tore my hand off, And then, so I had to correct that. So the next year I came back, and they would load on me, and I just, they went, uh-oh, God figured that out.
Right.
So next year I went 2-2 and started getting a little bit better, and took a while. I mean, you take your lumps in that sport.
Yeah.
But, there's a big buzz. I had a big buzz for quite a while, and then Clee Dean showed up, and that's a whole other thing.
Yep.
6'10".
Whoa.
600 pounds.
Yeah.
And he had a hand that when he made a fist looked like a volleyball.
Jesus Christ.
And he was a whole nother world. And that's who I ended up beating for and over the top. And that's the chapters on the arm wrestle in the book are awesome. But that experience and everything was a great time for me. I mean, I didn't do anything besides work.
Right.
And I mean, out for 2 years. I decided when I heard about the Over the Top, the best tournament ever, biggest tournament in our history, if I'm going to beat Cleve, and I went to work. And I mean, nobody did what I was doing that long. Yeah. And, I mean, it turned out, I dominated the world championship, and then the door opened for professional wrestling, and, I took that route, and I'm glad I did. I do miss the arm wrestling world. I loved it.
And you earned the name Flash in beating people so quick, right?
Yeah.
And so, go ahead.
There were periods of time in my career for like 4 years in a row, and nobody lasted long. I mean, nobody.
Wow.
Except for maybe Cleve. Cleve and Johnny didn't. I mean, I blew him right off the table. I mean, Johnny, they say he's the GOAT, the best of all time. And I don't know how, I understand I left after 10 years. But I was 3-0 against Johnny and played with him.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so that earned you kind of. Yeah. You played with him. It was, you beat him up pretty bad, huh?
Oh, it wasn't even competitive, you know. I mean, and everybody saw it. And, you know, I mean, it's not that we didn't compete. And then we pulled so much on the side for hours. And, I mean, he would just, he was so frustrated that, you know, because Johnny cracked every nut that he had to.
Yeah.
He beat everybody back that beat him. And he's so good, and he got to be so, and he's great. Believe me, he's an unbelievable. He'd have probably found a way. But it would have taken him years. It wouldn't have happened anytime soon. And even if it did, I don't know. Because, I mean, the gap I had to make up from me to Cleve Dean was larger than what Johnny would have to make up beating me.
Right, yeah.
And I'm not trying to be cocky or nothing, but, I mean, we trained that hard. And, all you can do is compare yourself to the other competitors, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, I mean, it's kind of frustrating a little bit, you know, because I left early. And, you know, they got the Hall of Fame for the Arm Wrestling Hall of Fame, and I'm not in it. And that's just blows my mind. I just don't understand it.
Yeah.
I mean, for 10 years, I lost 9 times in 10 years. Nobody that ever beat me wasn't a world champion. I never lost to anybody besides a former world champion. And I pulled them all, and I beat them all. You know what I mean? But I think they're pissed off at me because I left. I don't know. I mean, it's just crazy. You know, I mean, but that's something my wife tells me, you guys should let that go, you know, and it does kind of, you know, sometimes I sound like I'm complaining.
Right. Well,
but, you know, and I don't want to, but sometimes I guess I do. But it's, it was a lot of work, man. I mean, a ton of work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and you got, you mentioned earlier Over the Top, the championships, but you got to be part of Over the Top, the movie as well. How was that experience?
Oh, they wanted me to be have a pretty good part in the movie, but put it this way, your first wrestling match in, as a pro, you're so nervous, you can't even swallow, you can't breathe, you're kind of not, there could be 20 people on the crowd, it's tough. Get on the stage with Sylvester Stallone, never acted before, and try to talk a line out once. It just doesn't. I don't, my mouth, nothing to come out. I mean, and Glowline Globus was, he's, get that big son of a bitch off our stage, get him out of here. Because they really wanted me, because I won the tournament, you know, I mean, and they really wanted to use a lot of footage from it. And so I got to stay with the movie for about 5 weeks.
Wow.
I got paid just like I, you know, would have got if I was in the movie. But they just put live clips of me from my original match in the movie. But Rick Zumwalt, who was a pretty good arm wrestler, he was better than pretty good. He was above average. You know, he was like ranked somewhere between 10 and 20. And he's the guy that had the lead with Stallone, but he could act. I mean, he was phenomenal.
Right.
He did a great job. And, you know, and that's cool. You know, if I'd have had 5 years in the business and got comfortable in front of cameras and everything,
right,
I'd have thought that I could have done that part no problem. But, you know, that's just another way, you know, but it was impossible. I mean, it's just another world, you know, until you get comfortable and then, you know, Stallone was cool as hell. I mean, he's a great guy.
He was unbelievable. Yeah, he was pretty big at the time.
He was big. Box office big.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you, so after that, you kind of transitioned into the wonderful world that we know of pro wrestling. How'd you get your start there? I mean, you know, you were bouncing around and always been around like Rick Rude and, you know, but how did you get your start?
Well, when after, okay, before the Over the Top tournament, I went to Japan with the movie, promoting the movie in Japan.
Okay.
And New Japan approached me, and they knew that I was getting ready for this tournament. You know, Hawk was my buddy. I was his buddy, man. Me and him were buddies in high school, and
wow,
he talked me up to everybody, you know. And I mean, the first time I met Flair, he knew all, you know. God, Hawk's your best friend. That guy loves you, man. You know. And Hawk, you know, and so when I got to Japan, the office approached me and says, you know, if you'd like to, after this tournament, you know, think about a pro wrestling career, you should, you know, consider, you know, we'd like to, love to have, you know. And so, you know, I won the tournament and certain things happened. I got in touch with Hawk as a hawker. I says, New Japan, a good wrestling company? He says, why? Well, they want me to come in. He says, Nortz, if you don't take that, I'll fucking kill you. I mean, they didn't have cell phones back then. You know, it took a while to get in touch with him, you know. And I mean, he was. Then, you know, after he says, I'll kill you, then it started elevating, and he started yelling at me. I said, Hawk, give me a shot at this. You know, I'm going to do it.
That's awesome. Because
he wanted me to go right away, you know. And but it worked out better for me. You know, I wasn't ready for it as a 20, 21-year-old guy or, you know, young guy like, you know, Kurt, Rick, and Mike went, you know, they went early. And it worked out for me, you know. And New Japan was perfect for me. I mean, you know, you said that I wrestled WCW, then in the early 2000s went to New Japan. I never left New Japan all the time. I worked WCW. I stayed right with them. I mean, I was going back and forth all the time.
Right, and they had that working relationship where you know, where they would go back and forth between New Japan and WCW. You know, you see that nowadays in other organizations, and they've kind of always been the forefront or the leader of doing that, creating those relationships. And through that, you won the heavyweight championship.
Oh, in the IWGP?
Yeah.
Yeah, I won it twice, yeah. Me, you know, I won it twice as a tag in the tag leagues, and then I was a singles guy twice. Yeah, it was awesome, man. New Japan gave me a hell of a run. I gave them everything I had, and they took care of me for a long time. It was a great relationship. It was an awesome company to work for. And, you know, Japan fit me perfectly. And, I mean, timing's everything in this business.
You right.
know, I see a lot of guys come and go and never got a shot. And, you know, I got my shot with New Japan, then WCW, then, you know, got the NWO break, and we took the NWO over to Japan. It was huge. So, I mean, it just, timing worked out for me in the business, and, you know, it just, if I'd have gone earlier, I was probably just so irresponsible. I don't know if it would have worked out for me. You know, I mean, I was a young guy, just nuts.
Right.
And
yeah, I mean, so, no, that's. I think that's a great point for, you know, for anyone who is, you know, listening, who's younger, you know, getting into wrestling. Because I got into the ring when I was 24, 25 when I started. And I think that if I would have, you know, gone in and taken bumps at a younger age, you know, 19, 20 years old, it just wouldn't have been the same, because that maturity level is definitely something.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a different perspective, you know. Yeah. I mean, wrestling's there's more to it than just going out there and being able to do the, you know, the moves and this, that. There's a lot more to it, and you gotta, it needs to slow down for you.
Right.
Until it slows down for you, you really don't understand it.
Right.
And, you know, once it starts slowing down, then you start you know, start breathing a little bit, get some comfortable, and it starts really rolling for you, you know. And so, yeah, it's just a combination of a few things, but it definitely worked out for me waiting.
Yeah, and with that too, you know, you're only one of a handful of guys, including, you know, Kenny Omega, who's ultra popular now, to have held the IWGP championship, you know, that is not a Japanese wrestler. What was that like, finding out that, you know, hey, we're gonna, you know, that first time they were gonna bestow that upon you? Did you know, like, was it that day that you found out? Did you know a little bit in advance?
No. They groomed me for that spot. Yeah. They test you. They make sure that, I mean, you gotta, it just doesn't happen, especially the pedigree when I was working with that officer, Masato,
right,
Inoki, Fujinami, Sagaguchi. The history of that company, you had to pay your dues, and you had to prove to them that you worked through. You ain't going to miss matches. That your effort has got to be, it ain't no nights off. You got, I mean, it's a grind.
Right.
And half the office is always against you. They don't want an American to have it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're, you know, it's a Japanese company, and it just, you really got to, you know, you got to tear it up. You know, here's an example that's kind of crazy, but I mean, Benoit was unbelievable.
Yeah. And oh, without a question.
Did Chris have the IWGP Junior Championship?
I think he
had the tag. I'm not sure if he had the singles one.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up.
If he didn't, that's crazy. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
He worked his ass off. I mean, it was just, you know, it's, for what happened outside of the ring, it's terrible what happened.
Right.
But for what he did inside the ring, and what, you know, I mean, and, you know, and he, I'm not saying I worked harder than he did, but he had to do that.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so then when they, you know, when they start getting you ready for it, you know, you got to, you know, you don't, you know, take days off. You know, I've had some injuries that I worked through that were crazy. And I mean, super crazy. And, you know, any football player would have been, the season would have been over.
Right.
Six, seven times, you know.
Right.
And I had two of them at the same time.
Yeah.
But you just push through, you know, and I mean, and they see that. And then, you know, the fans, you got to get good responses with the people. Just, it's a whole bunch, you know, it's not like they don't push somebody on the group, you know, that you gotta work your way up. But then as time went on, you know, I mean, Bob Sapp got it later on.
Right.
Years later, which is, I think Bob's a great guy. I mean, I really had some nice time, you know, the few times I met Bob, is really cool dude, but he didn't earn that. You know, that wasn't right. You know, and that's when Simon and Inoki took over, you know. And
right. That, yeah.
The company kind of was in a tailspin there for a while. And, you know, because, I mean, the history of that company, and to get them to buy in was tough.
Yeah. And looking it up here, Benoit did. He had the belt August 19th, 1990. Yeah, Benoit was when he was wrestling as Pegasus Kid. That's when he got it. And he got it off of Liger. But the first, this is interesting, I didn't know this, the first non-Japanese winner for the junior heavyweight was Owen. Owen Hart won it in 1988.
I started in the 90s, so yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know. Yeah, well, that's cool as heck.
Yeah. Yeah, that says a lot. That says a lot, man. That's amazing.
Yeah. And you had
home was great over there, man.
Oh yeah, he absolutely was. And you had Scott. You had a pretty extensive tag titles run as well, too. You know, is there a particular team or a few that you thought, you know, really made a great business? You know, a great bit of business for you.
Yeah, Jurassic Powers, me and Herc.
That's right.
Unbelievable.
Hercules Hernandez.
And, you know, brother, he was, he helped me a lot. He was, a stud in the ring. And he worked a style that was really conducive to help. You know, that my society loved him.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he helped elevate me. You know, I was still kind of, you know, getting my feet underneath me, and Herc was, man, he was a great mentor, and I mean, he was a badass brother. I mean, and then, you know, the match we had with the Steiner brothers.
Yes. Oh, man.
Those are, you know, yeah, we did a, you know, we're the first all Gaijin eight match as a main event.
Yeah.
And the Budokan. And,
yeah.
And the Japanese op was going nuts. And then people went crazy. We had that place just swinging. Awesome. It was, and, you know, Scotty and Rick, they're great wrestlers, brother. They don't get enough credit.
Nope, I agree.
They really don't, man. Those guys were, they were studs, man. And, I mean, they, you know, they had a hell of a deal, too. Me and Herc would work these 3-4 week tours, and they would come in the last night of the tour. and they did it 10 times a year.
Wow.
And nine of them, or eight of them, they were working me and Herc.
Wow.
Me and Herc would be just beat the. We were just dragging ass, and here comes Scotty and Rick. they haven't wrestled in 10 days, and they're jogging around the ring and all the rest and everything. And we're over there, you know, we got ice bags hanging off every freaking corner of our body. Got to get in the ring with them so bitches.
They work pretty snug, too, right?
Oh, hell. Yeah, big time. I said, I have more Steiner miles than I do Delta miles. Scotty, you're half the match are in the freaking air.
Right.
When we went back and forth, we had a great, unbelievable run with those guys. And, you know, I had a match one time where Scotty tore his bicep. Hmm. And he was in a position where he didn't have to push through it. Oof. He can go get the surgery, take care of it, do it right. When I tore mine, I just kept working. So him and his brother, we just recently dropped the belts. The Muda and Hossie. Mm-hmm. And Muda and Hossie are Russell Steiner brothers. When Scotty tore his bicep, me and Rick, I filled in for Scott, and I took Scott's place, and me and Rick wrestled the match.
That's awesome.
And Muda was, Sega Gucci was Muda's boy. Gooch loved Muda.
Mm-hmm.
Well, me and Rick got so much heat on Muda, we were just, I mean, it was nuts. And Rick suplexed Muda belly to back outside. And I remember he did it. He was at the rail, and Muda's holding on to the railing. And Rick kept trying to rip him, and the railing's coming up. Finally, Muda couldn't hold on anymore, and he just let him go.
Oh!
And Muda landed on his back shoulders, and he just slid all the way down the mat to the other railing. It just made this. It was a car wreck. And Gucci came out of the skybox up there, and he came running down ringside. He was ripping his tie off. He wanted to kill Rick. No. But, you know, so and then we just kept it going. And, I mean, so we're just getting the heat on Muda. And finally, you know, they make this big comeback. And all of a sudden, they turn the heat around. And Muda and Hossie are working heel on Rick. and they're getting this place all fired up, and they're just beating us. I mean, they turned the match. It was unbelievable. And all of a sudden, I got the hot tag. And then it really, I mean, not really, but it just went to another level. So anyways, it was just an awesome match. And I ended up, I can't remember, it was such a good match, I can't remember what happened at the end of it. But anyways, like two tours later, Scotty's back, and Rick's there, and I can't remember the name of the magazine. They presented me and Rick an award for match of the year for that match.
Really?
And Scotty wanted to kill me because I kept bringing that up. I come in the locker room. I go, hey, Rick. He goes, yeah, Scott. I said, you ever win match of the year in New Japan? He says, yep, one time. I said, yeah, who's your partner? He goes, you, Norton. And all of a sudden, Scotty be over there, and I look at me. It was like steam coming out of his ear. He's hurt. That was so easy to get him pissed off.
It seems like
and,
it.
Oh, God. Oh, and, hey, it's hell to pay, too, brother. Believe me. But, Scotty was great. I loved working with Scotty. Me and him had a great deal going on. Well, yeah, those are good days. Some tag matches. In Japan, tags are huge, big time. They'll never not be. Like, here in the States, they've gotten away from that, but over there, the tag matches are huge. And I mean, it's usually a super long match, and even six-man tags. You know, we've done house shows before where it'd be three big Americans against three of the best Japanese baby faces, and the place would be just roaring. It was such great memories and great times. I just loved it.
So in Japan, I've always kind of wondered this. I don't think I've asked any of the boys this question. And that is, you know, obviously you're doing the shows, you're traveling. But just like in the States, you're doing the same thing. You're doing shows and you're traveling. So is the nightlife the same in Japan, or is it a little more disciplined where guys don't really go out, don't really, you know, have a couple drinks? Or is it, you know, find that local, you know, bar when you get into town and just have a couple and unwind?
Well, you see, the thing about it is that the opportunities in Japan are few and far between.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of bars in Japan.
Right.
There's Roppongi in Tokyo where there's a lot of American bars. There are, like, British pubs and stuff around, spread out through Tokyo. But a lot of times, you know, after you get done, you know, you're traveling on the bus or whatever, you get to the town after, you know, you go back to your hotel room and you're going to party it up. You drink beer at the restaurants you eat at.
Yeah.
I mean, they all serve beer. And, I mean, it's nowhere near what it's like here with how the guys, you know, like, they're clubbing, man. I mean, they're all, you know, Japan, that don't happen like that. So, I mean, but no, I mean, on the bus, they got stocked 2-3 cases of beer. You know, the bus is a high-end bus, beautiful bus, and it's got coolers in the bus. Oh, refrigerated, so you know, I mean, it was
that's nice.
Top of that, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, there was never a shortage for beer. And I'll tell you something. You go bust your ass in the ring for 45 minutes and six-man tag or whatever, and you got a two-hour drive, and those damn beers taste good afterwards. And
oh,
I mean,
yeah. Yep.
I always sat one row in front of the cooler. It was on my back left side. Barbarian always sat in front of me. And Barb never said a word. All he'd do was put his hand back and squeeze my ankle. And I would just set my hand up in the air. And the young boy behind me would open beer and end up my hand, and I'd stick it forward and Barb. And that happened about 18 times. We had a system down, but we had great times on that, doing that, you know, traveling on the bus. There's a lot of hard times, too. Long, long,
yeah,
you know, bus rides and whatnot. But, you know, we had some just outs. It's just a different kind of travel and camaraderie there, you know. But we had some outstanding times. And, you know, there's, like, some of these restaurants, I mean, there are places in Japan where the office would just take the whole gaijin, the whole bus. And if it's a long drive, they just pull into some, you know, there's a place in Earthquake hit it, for crying out loud. What steakhouse? But we'd pull in there, and the owner would just feed all the boys, and it was just amazing.
That's great.
And I mean, the food was outstanding, and that happened a lot. So, and you know, we always had a really, really great time. I mean, traveling there was hard. I mean, it was, but we traveled, you know, first class when we flew, the bullet trains, we took the bullet trains and the bus.
Yeah.
You know, the bus was just a beautiful bus. I mean, I've never been on such a good bus. And, you know, but it was hard, you know. I mean, you're wrestling 18 out of 21 days sometimes, you know. Right. I mean, and then you go home for a week and you're right back and you're doing same thing again. And so it was a grind, but there were some really great times. I had a lot of fun.
Scott, I got a question for you. You were part of the NWO in your WCW days. Who would you say was the biggest faction ever? I know you had a great time with NWO, and I really want you to talk about it. But out of all the factions through the years in the business, who do you feel like had the biggest impact?
I don't know how you say anything other than the NWO.
Right.
I mean, you know, Hogan turned heel, Paul Nash were on fire. These arenas, it didn't matter. They're sold.
Right. Yep.
In the ring, you know, like, all right, you always heard, you know, I heard an interview with Booker's doing one time, and he says, I got me a Road Warrior pop where the crowd just went nuts. Boom.
Right.
Yeah.
We lived with those. I mean, when we had these run-ins and what was going on with, you know, all the boys and the way Monday Nitro was just on fire.
Oh, man, I watched every episode.
It was just outstanding, yeah. But then, you know, you look at, you know, the Four Horsemen back in the day. They were so cool.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was just odd. I mean, you know, so, but for me, that we took that to Japan.
Yes.
It was monstrous in Japan.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrestled Peter Arts in the Sumo Palace.
Oh, man.
In 2017, the end of 2000, in December, as a main event, there was probably 150 NWO shirts out there.
Wow.
And I'm just going, good night, man. And, you know, this thing will never go away. And it's just, so I was part of that, so I'm always going to say that. But I mean, you know, that the NX or whatever, you know, New York had that thing going on. They're always going to be. And then, you know, I mean, but from my perspective, the NWO was just, it was just so successful. But, you know, I wish it would have, I didn't like the way it ended up.
Factions and everything. Yeah, it was strongest when it was, you know, NWO, Black and White. Even the Wolfpack, you know, was very good during its time. And then, like you said.
Yeah, but it got too good, then all of a sudden somebody said, well, I got to get in the Wolfpack now.
Right.
Right.
So there was no, I mean, once that happened, what's the Wolfpack against? Is it, you know, kind of against the reason why they made the Wolfpack?
Right, exactly. Well, you know, what's interesting, what's interesting creatively, too, and this is something that I always, it just kind of bugged me in a sense, and that is when they brought you in, this was, to me, you're bringing someone who is definitely a strong style, definitely tough, and you had, you know, a built reputation, especially in Japan, arguably as popular as Hogan, I would say, you know. But then, by adding more people to it, they just essentially, you know, turned the creative to, okay, we can put them on and make them almost the, you know, I don't, not jobbers, but the, you know, the guys who can, you know, make people look strong, and yet they're still part of the NWO. And I thought the NWO, you should have just, everyone who was brought in should have just been, you know, almost impeccable. Like, you know, you really can't touch them. Build, you know, 7 or 8 guys that it's this fortress.
See, it got too big. You're right. Yeah. But, you know, Eric did the best he could to keep it as strong as he could, but there's people with creative control of their own,
yeah,
characters, and it's a huge juggling act for him.
Yep.
And everybody thinks he, you know, could have done better here, could have done better. I'd love to see somebody try to juggle that, what he did. And a lot of the problem with me was that I was going back and forth from Japan, you know.
Right.
And, you know, everybody says, you know, Scott didn't get the push he deserved, and I might not have. And I know I mean, given a bigger, you know, better opportunities, maybe. I mean, the same guys I worked in Japan and tore the house down with, you know what I mean? And, you know, I don't know if I had the most, I never want to, I'm not sure that some of the bookers looked at me like they, you know, they work at a, you know, Kevin Sullivan might not have wanted to push me, you know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, and that's just the way it is. You know, I mean, I see Kevin, and I, you know, no hard feelings or anything, but I felt that he just didn't have my best, you know, but he's got a lot of guys he needs to take care of, you know?
Right.
And half the time, you know, I'm running out of Japan anyways.
Right. Well,
I was never going to lose my Japan deal. Never.
Yeah. And the thing, too, is what's interesting about that is, in a sense, you were 20 years ahead of your time. Because if you were doing what you did back then now, it would be, you'd be, like, totally blown up. And, you know, because you could use the internet to,
sure,
you know, to further it.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at, you know, like the Young Bucks and these guys that, yep, they've got so much exposure, and they're great. I mean, yep, but the, you know, the style's changed. I mean,
definitely. Yeah.
The big man in this business, you know, is kind of like, you know, it's still using big guys, but not, you know. I was talking with Eric Bischoff and Bob Orton, and I says, you know, what's happened to our sport? You know, I'm not sure there's a place for us, because it's like Cirque du Soleil. I mean,
right? Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I'm like, you know, you can get some guy hopping around the ring, I'm gonna, you know, stop him like a freaking hit a wall.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a different, it was a, you know, I mean, I worked a lot of smaller guys, all of them, and they love working with me, you know, but I mean, it's just different now. I mean,
well, and you said, though, but
unbelievable.
But you said one of the key things earlier on, and that is slowing it down. And I think that's very important. I think that, you know, any guy that I run into who is a younger guy, and I've been watching matches and stuff, you know, I'll point out things and I'll say, you know what, you did this right because you took the time. Something as simple as, you know, when you punch someone, shake your hand a little bit. Like it, you know, like, damn, that kind of hurt.
Fill the gaps in.
You fill the gaps in, exactly.
It's not just spot. Yep. Move. You know, I mean, I remember I just got back from Japan. I was in Japan for a month. I get a phone call from Eric. He asked me to go wrestle. He says, I need you in Milwaukee, Chicago, and Detroit the next three nights. I says, Eric, I just got back from Japan. He says, Hall's supposed to wrestle Flair, and he can't make it. Oof. I need you to fill in for him. So I'm just dead on my feet. So I'm wrestling Flair now in the main event. You know, that's 45 minutes. And I'm still got laid out of my freaking mind. So, you know, and he's so easy, it's unbelievable. I mean, it was a great week for me. I learned a lot.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, slowing down. So anyways, we're going back and forth, and all of a sudden, me and Rickon going at it, and all of a sudden, I shot Rick in the corner, and I just come charging him. When I told him, give me a hip toss when you come out of it, right? So as when I do a hip toss in Japan like that, where somebody moves out of the corner, I come out of that corner, I'm just moving.
Yeah.
And I just fly right over, you know what I mean? And I get up good height and everything, take a big bump, boom. Well, Rick comes walking out of the corner, and he's doing the woo-woo, and he's doing his hair and everything. he even thought about doing a hip toss yet, and all of a sudden, here I come flying right over his shoulder. And all of a sudden, he just made, like, his right arm like it was the hip toss motion. She goes, woo, and he says, we'll do that tomorrow, too. And the way it yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's funny as hell.
Yeah.
But I was rushing him so bad. And by the last night, you know, I picked up with how he did things and everything.
Yeah.
And 45 minutes wasn't so bad no more.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, and I mean, and you got to slow down. You got to, you know, sometimes you need to worry what you're doing between these spots, you know, right. You're making sure you got the people you're working with, you know, the referee, you know, you got the hard camera and all this stuff's going through your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're just picking, grabbing, going for it. I wrestled Wayne Bloom in my first match. 20-minute Broadway, right?
Yeah.
We went over that match 20 times.
Wow.
At 4 minutes, I had Wayne in the bear hug, and the match was over. I did everything. Wayne was like, I threw him around like a rag doll. It was supposed to be this big, long, dragged out thing. He could, I was so blowed up. When I came back to the locker room, that, you know, they just rang the bell and I beat Wayne.
Oh,
and he was a tag champ, you know, the destruction crew. Wahoo McDaniels wanted to kill me. and then, you know, why would they put me in a 20-minute Broadway, my first match.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, God dang it. I mean, it takes a while to figure that stuff out.
Yeah.
And I did. I mean, and I was so blowed up. I mean, I was breathing hard an hour later on the way home.
Oh, man.
I mean, you just couldn't sell down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, that's for sure.
Well, let me ask you, Scott, how much of the product do you watch these days?
Not a lot. I mean, I do watch sometimes, but not that I'm disconnected from it. It's not that I don't love it, but I just, I really, you know, I don't make sure I see Raw, but if I see it, it's on, you know, I'll pay attention to it. You know, then I get kind of hooked for that night.
Yeah.
And I'll watch, you know, and then like, you know, when I was with New Japan, when I, you know, I watched all the matches and stuff like that, but you know, you just try to, you know, just I'm not studying tape and
on
it all the time, you know.
What would you say, though, when your TV is on and you and Tammy are, you know, settling in for the night, what do you guys enjoy that's on TV now?
You know, I'm a sports guy.
Are you still
We do watch, like, she's got me watching This Is Us and stuff like that.
So,
hey, man. You got to do that stuff every once in a while.
That's right. And you got to watch it strong style.
Yeah.
No tears.
Yeah, tough guy here. Hey, I tell you what. That damn show can get you more emotional than... They can flip the switch. Anyway. But, you know, I mean, I'm a big hockey fan and, of course, football. Not too much in the NFL or NBA anymore.
Do you...
Kind of...
Do you root for the Wild, or do you root for the Stars?
The Stars, bro. Yeah. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I never left, man.
Yeah.
when they left, I followed them. I love the Dallas Stars.
Yeah.
I mean, we came so close to beating St. Louis.
Yep.
Double overtime, man. Next year's be great. So, but yeah, I love hockey. I'm a sports guy. You know, I like watching the muscle car shows.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I got bitch and rides on right now.
Nice.
Wow.
Nice.
It's just fun, you know. I just enjoy that. You know, I watch a good bit of cooking shows, too. Diners, Drives, and Dives.
Oh, man, I love that show.
Yeah.
Every time I go to a place they go to, I try to make sure I go.
The only thing about it reminds me of freaking Knobs.
That's true.
I mean... But, you know, what a job he's got, huh?
Oh, man. I always wonder how he keeps the pounds off.
Right.
I think he might be doing the choke and puke stuff right there.
Yeah. Or he takes one bite and then the cameramen take over.
Yeah, right.
Something.
It's the bucket.
Some of that stuff, good. Nice.
Yeah.
Hey, Scott, I have a question for you, man. You have this new book that's out. How was it writing this book? Being that this is the I'm assuming this is your first time writing a book as an author. How was it putting this together?
I wasn't the author. Adam Randis was the author.
Oh, okay.
It was great.
Scott,
like I said earlier.
Yeah, Scott, you got to forgive DJ because. He was actually adjusting something, and he missed that first part of the...
I did.
Don't worry about that stuff. See, it's going to get worse. As we get older, I mean, I don't know how old the DJ is, but...
Yeah.
No, I mean, Adam Miranda's the guy that is the author of the book. You know, he had... He was my biggest fan, and I mean, he's
gotcha.
Got every match chronologically laid out. So he made it so easy on me.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have these matches. I had a match against Muta one time, and I was injured, and everybody knew I was injured, and I forgot all about it. You know, I never. And also, he started. He says, "Remember a match you had with Muta?" And he started popping a date out, and also he started talking about the finish, you know, and started talking about the match. I'm going, yeah, it was cold as hell in that damn building. And next thing you know, we got a chapter. I'm just going, or, you know, I got a good, you know, part of a chapter. And, I mean, he just remembered everything. And it was great. I mean, it was hard. I mean, it took a long time. I mean, I shared more stuff with this guy than anybody.
Wow.
That's so, amazing. I mean, Sarah, And the book is phenomenal. Wait till you read it. I mean, it's a great read. I'm super proud of it. I'm super confident in this book. And it's just, you know, I never thought it happened, but, you know, I mean, I'm glad I did it. It's pretty cool.
That's awesome. And you, one of the things I hope you talked about, and I'm going to ask you about it right now, is you served a little bit as a bodyguard for the Purple One, Prince.
That's about all I say in the book, too. No, because when you're hired on by him, you're in a room with about 4 or 5 lawyers.
Yeah.
And you sign more confidential paperwork that you'll never talk about what's happened. Everything's, you know, it's insane. And I remember working, doing the Purple Rain tour and everything that happened there, and I got released later on, you know, months later, and I did a arm wrestling tournament. I won an international arm wrestling championship of the United States and Canada, and the Star Tribune did a thing in the paper. Then I was on a local TV show, Twin Cities Live, and they asked me about it. And I just, you know, it was live. And I said, well, I can't really talk about that. And by the end of that day, the contact number I gave him years earlier was my parents' home, and his lawyers contacted my parents.
Wow.
Holy crap.
We need to talk to Scott. And I'm just going, I didn't say anything.
Wow.
And I'm just going, man, this is insane. And so I guess it's even worse now after he's passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I really don't go into it. You know, it's something that happened. It was pretty cool. You know, it was totally out of my, you know, I mean, okay, how do I put this? I mean, you know, me, Scott Norton with the, it just, I was kind of out of place a little bit. I mean, yeah, I mean, everybody else, when, you know, I was a jeans kind of guy. I mean, these dudes are, these body, you know, we were wearing, the clothes was crazy. So, you know, I mean, everybody had these pants suits and all this crap, and I, you know, I was a normal guy, you know what I mean? I mean, when I had to wear what I did when I worked, I wore it.
Right.
When it's, you know, my time, man, I ain't wearing that crap.
Did you ever get a chance to, the one thing that fascinates me, and I know is, you know, some of the celebrities have talked about getting a chance to play ping pong with them.
No. Nice. No. Never did. No. Basketball.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, because that's the other thing. Yeah.
That's legendary, too. Hey, Scott, let me ask you.
This is a true story.
Oh, there it is.
I blocked this guy's shot. I'm not sure who it was. But when I did, the whole place just went quiet. I'm like, what the hell's going on? Let's go. You know, I mean,
right?
It was. So that was kind of crazy. But no, yeah, I, you know, if we were at a bar having a couple beers, I could talk all night about it. But
yeah,
yeah, oh yeah.
No, we'll take you up on that when we catch up with you when you're in Vegas next. So,
cool.
Yeah, Scott, things are definitely more tame now than they were back in the days when you were running the roads. What's the craziest story that you've got? Like a oh shit story where it was just so far out there, and you probably have a few of them. But is there one that you could point to that was just like, yeah, this is the top?
I mean, how does, I really don't, like a rib or?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I would say a rib.
God, I mean, there's a lot of them. I mean, when you know, this is you know, it's in the book, but I was sharing a room with the Destruction Crew years ago, right when I first started. And we all had, these are the hotel rooms that you pull up and you step out of your car and the door's right there and you go in your room.
Right.
So it's me, Wayne, and Mike Enos. We've been partying the whole day in the van, to the show. After, I mean, just those guys are crazy. And it's, you know, it's not like I'm trying to say it. Don't do this. We're all doing it, you know. So anyways, what happened on that tour was absolutely insane. So, you know, we're drinking beer, and right at the end of the night, somehow or another, somebody ended up putting a sleeping pill in my beer.
Oh, no.
And I, that night, it was my turn for the rollaway bed, meaning that it was twin beds, and then they had a rollaway. You know?
Right.
So I'm sleeping on this rollaway bed.
Uh-oh.
And I go out like a light, and about 40 degrees, 30 degrees. It was cold as hell outside.
Oh, no.
And I wake up outside. It will be outside. I'm wearing a pair of boxer shorts.
Oh, my.
I'm freezing. And what the pricks did is they wheeled me in front of the not in front of their door, the door of the room I was staying in, the next one over.
Oh.
So I started beating on the door. I said, I'm going to kill you, some bitches. And I'm just, and the poor guy inside the room, he don't know what's going on. Monster's trying to get in the room to kill him. That guy didn't have a gun. He shot and killed me.
Right.
Shit.
I mean, I'm just going nuts. So the police show up. And just as that happened, here comes Wayne walking out. He goes, oh, shit, he's sleepwalking again. We're so sorry. And he kind of leads me back into the room, and I'm just going, this fucking guy. I'll never forget that. You know? And that Canadian tour we did, that was just unbelievable. But there was stuff like that all the time. Guys would do that crap all the time. So
what,
yeah, there, you know, Kurt Hennett had a ton of them. I mean... Kurt was insane, and, you know, there's a lot of crazy shit went on all the time, you know.
Well, you know, let's finish on the note of, you know, North Korea. I know our buddy here, Sin City Steve, who you know, couldn't be with us today, you know, he's fascinated with the whole North Korea story. And we just talked to Sonny Ono recently, and we got, you know, his version of everything that went on. And I know you've recanted it. You've talked about it, and, you know, in the book, you've talked about it, you know, on different interviews. But I think my biggest question would be, okay, we know that here you are. You just get back to your room and you start talking to Tammy. And she has no clue about the atmosphere in North Korea. What was it like when you're trying to talk to her about this in terms of, you know, the emotion going on of, you know, here you're newly married and you're trying to convey this?
What the problem was is that I tried to contact her for 2 days, 3 days.
Right.
And they let me through and they had my phone bugged.
Wow.
And you know, and she didn't understand that. And why would she?
Right.
You know, she figures I'm just not calling because I'm going nuts. So we got a pretty good argument there, you know. And then when I said what I did and they didn't like it, they cut the line and all hell broke loose. So, I get to that really good. The chapter on that in the book is it's pretty crazy.
Was it emotional?
You know, I was just, you know, in business with Eric, and we talked about it quite a bit. I've talked to Eric, probably more to Eric about what happened there than anybody else. And I always said, you know, I've always said Eric was crazy because he knew what was going on in North Korea.
Yeah.
I didn't. I just went. You know, my office told me, New Japan, you're going to North Korea. I said, okay, no.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going. But, you know, Eric knew. And, you know, when we discussed it, we're both so happy we did it.
Right.
Because, I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, you know, the 195,000 people, is just, the shows are just out of hand. And, you know, what we saw over there and what happened, and I've never been to a place like that, and I never probably will be again. Great memories.
Did emotion, I mean, how was it emotionally on you going through, you know, essentially what was, you know?
Well, after what happened, up until then, I was kind of upset.
Yeah.
With the North Koreans. I mean, when they wanted something from you, instead of saying, "Hey, Mr. Scott, would you come with us, please?" They just come over and grab you.
Wow.
And that didn't work. You know, I mean, I yanked my arm away from them, you know, and they just, like, Mossy said, "Scott, you got to just relax." I says, "Man, I can't tug on you like that."
Yeah.
And, you know, when they had my room bugged, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, and I thought it was, you know, I mean, I thought it was over. I really did.
Yeah.
And so that puts a whole, you know, I still had another match to wrestle. I still had to get out of there.
Yeah.
You know, we had these dinners at the Capitol, their Capitol. It was freaky. You know, a lot of guys are freaked out. I mean, Flair was just absolutely, what they asked of Rick, all the propaganda and things they wanted him to say, the pressure they put on him, he was visibly shaken. I mean, and I don't blame him a bit.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was crazy.
So
that's good. The North Korea chapter, it's a really good chapter. It's one of the better chapters in the book, and we got Muhammad Ali there. And
right. Yep.
It was unbelievable. It was a really cool, you know, looking back at it, I'm super glad I did it. I'm really grateful that we got out of there alive.
Is it strange to you? Well, first of all, I mean, it's amazing that what you experienced, if you were to go back today and they dropped you in just right now out of the blue, it's amazing that everything is the exact same, that you'd probably see stuff that you saw exactly the same, you know, 25 years ago, which is nuts.
What I've seen of it, it hasn't changed a bit.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that's crazy. And it's just, they're people. We were going to the show, and they would, two guys do a car, and there's these little green Mercedes-Benz. It was me and Flair going to the first show, the first night.
Wow.
And we're riding along in this car, and there are people everywhere.
Wow.
Hundreds of thousands of them walking. And I went, Rick, I said, look at this. I said, we're really drawing big time here, man. This is unbelievable. And that was the night I was the main event. You know, I'm just like, this is crazy. The limo driver says, excuse me, can I speak? And I said, you speak English? Yeah, talk. I said, we haven't talked to anybody speak you know, and he spoke pretty good English, right? He says, what do you mean by draw?
Oh.
And I said, the people that are showing up for the show, they really want to see this. He said, no, they don't care. I said, what do you mean? He says, if they don't show up, they get a bullet in the head. Forced attendance.
Oh, damn.
I said, great. Flair could have been talked after that.
Shit.
Wow, man.
Rick was talking to himself at times, and it was out of hand, man. So, yeah, I'll never forget that forced attendance.
Go ahead.
And the driver was so serious.
Wow.
I'm going, God, I wish he didn't, he didn't have to tell me that.
Right.
Yeah. So is it?
So the whole, everybody showed up.
Yeah.
But then the thing about it is, we didn't get real close to the civilian people, you can call them civilians if you want. But that's really as close as you got to them unless you're in the ring.
Right.
And then you're not really comparing them anyways. But if you looked at them, they were so small. Man. I mean, 60 pounds.
Man.
So skinny and thin, and their faces all sunken, and their teeth were just in horrible shape. And they were starving. Everybody was starving. There wasn't a heavy guy there besides, whatever his name was.
Wow.
And,
Kim Jong.
King,
Is
it Ul or Ing or whatever that is.
Yeah, the
I've often blocked that out of my mind, but
does it blow your mind that out of all the people in the whole fucking world, the one person who seemed to have been able to break through and get to know Kim Jong-un a little bit is fucking Dennis Rodman?
I firmly believe there's no doubt in my mind that they just did that. Just put their nose, thumb to their nose, go, to the United States.
Yeah.
There's no question in my mind.
It's unbelievable.
Yes, I mean, if you think Dennis Rodman to go over and talk politics with them people,
right.
I'm surprised he made it back twice.
Yeah, right. Seriously.
I mean,
look
at that. If you think about what that Daniel Warmbier, his name, the guy that they killed.
Yeah,
yeah.
He took a poster off the wall.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I mean, they killed him.
Yep.
I mean, I think I did I was pretty much in line for to be executed. This guy, in the United States, that's no big deal.
Yep.
You took a little souvenir from the hotel room. I mean, put another one in there. Heck. And, Scottie Steiner was kind of, he was a little curious about what was going on around.
Oh, man.
It just wasn't a good. That was nuts.
Bad vibe, but an experience that you won't, trade because you got to do something that was, how many Americans can actually say it? Just you guys, basically, and Rodman.
They should bring it. They do the 20-year mark, which was a few years back. They should have got everybody together and did a big podcast or an interview.
Oh.
Everybody could have told their experiences and everything. That'd have been cool as hell.
Well, absolutely. Scott, when you say stuff like that, some of our minds here just go wild and go, 25 years is coming up next year, so I got a feeling.
Somebody needs to put that together. I mean, because I tell you, if you put us all together, we start talking, and all of a sudden you start pulling out memories, and there was some, it was what I saw and what I remember, and it was such a hopeless place to be. I never saw a bird.
Wow.
The only time I saw any grass was as soon as he got close to the inner city. And then they made it look like it was a real big kind of a deal, you know. But that city was so small, it was unbelievable.
Wow, man.
And it was just insane. These homes were just, they were filthy. And there were just this hundreds of same buildings, identical.
Wow.
Rows and rows. But it looked like the only thing it didn't have is bars, prison bars, you know.
Yeah. Just,
wow.
It was just horrible. And, wow. It was an eye-opening experience, that's for sure.
And
their food was absolutely horrific.
Oh, man. Wow. Wow. Well, you know, as I understand it, when the plane landed back in the States, Ric Flair got down on his knees and kissed the ground. Is that correct?
In a rainstorm.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. Man.
In a $3,500 suit. Wow.
That's how serious that was.
Wow. He was. And then we went out for sushi.
Oh, man.
And there's a little backstory to that, too. He took everybody out for sushi. I set my alarm so I make sure, because we go right back on the road next day.
Wow.
And they didn't, I mean, they just, you work so, I mean, we were just right on tour. Boom.
Wow.
So I set my alarm and I got all my stuff ready to go. All you got to do is shower up and get dressed and go. So anyways, they got these beautiful bathtubs at the Kio Plaza. And so I wake up in the morning and I decide I'm just going to soak for a little bit. I'm sore as hell. That match I had with Hashimoto, beat the daylights out of each other. The shower in Korea was absolutely horrific.
Oh, man. The
water pressure was like a trickle.
Oh.
So I sat in the bathtub and I fell asleep.
Oh, no.
And the next thing I saw, Tori wake me up and goes, "Why are you sleeping in tub?" I flooded the room out.
Oh.
The water was running. Now I'm rushing around, and I said, "Oh, for crying out loud, what else is going on?" But I did wake up. That's the only time I was ever late for the bus. One time in my whole career.
Oh, man, that's just priceless. You know, that's the best thing is that I think that the stories. You know, I think everyone kind of gets. You know, that focus and vision on the in-ring stuff, and you know, and it's great. I mean, we're all fans of wrestling. You know, you love the stories.
Some of the stuff that went outside of the ring was the camaraderie we had as friends and buddies. It's you know, like you sit there and you hear these ball players go, "I'm going to miss the locker room." Well, they're right. Yeah. I used to think that, you know, when Scott Hall was doing that E30 or what it was,
right? The
what are you gonna do when they quit cheering? When you don't hear the fans quit cheering? I always thought that was a cop out.
Yeah,
I always thought that was like, you know, but it's not. You know, I mean, you miss it. You miss all that stuff. You know, and you miss your buddies.
Yeah,
this is a really cool story. Me and Brad Armstrong are wrestling Masa Saito and Hashimoto.
Oh, man.
Brad Armstrong drop kicks Masa Saito right in the mouth. And I mean, just planted him.
Oh.
And the first thing Brad did is look at me and went, "Oh, shit." and the first thing that went through my mind is, Masa's going to get even.
Oh,
and they did this little spot a little bit later on, and all of a sudden Masa clotheslined that son of a Brad, and Brad took the bump and he looked at me and he says, "Recito." Well, he works his way back up, and then Massa really cleaned his clock. I said, "There's a receipt, Brad."
Oh,
he came over. He came over and tagged me, and Brad's just like, he's half, you know, and I'm just going, "Good night."
Oh.
But that was Massa. I mean, he never complained, but he always took care of it in the ring.
Yeah.
So anyway, that night on the bus, Brad's feelings might have been a little hurt because Massa straight in the mouth, big time, you know?
Yeah.
So his Massa always sat from the second to the front seat up on the right-hand side of the bus, and we always sat towards that back of the bus. So Massa, he comes walking back. He's got a bottle of beer in his hand. And he walks up, and we're all talking, and he leans right in front of Brad, and we're talking. He goes, "Keep talking. This is fun. I'm having fun. This is great." So we're talking back and forth. It kind of was, you know, unusual because Massa would never do this. And all of a sudden, Massa's laughing and looking around. And all of a sudden, he didn't have the bottle open. The cap's still on the bottle. He sticks the bottle in his eye, and he turns it, and he already had the cap loosened up, right? But when he turned it, Massa made the noise. He went, like it opened up, then all of a sudden he's got the bottle cap hanging in his eye like a pirate patch.
Oh.
And takes a sip of the beer. Brad Armstrong, I was looking at Massa, he's just going, "My God." And then Massa just turns around, walks back up the front of the bus. He goes, "Did you see that? He opened that fucking bottle with his eye." He opened the bottle of beer with his eye. And I said, "Yeah, you catered him tonight. What's the matter with you?" He goes, "He opened that damn bottle with his eye." Brad's just freaking out.
Oh, my God.
So about 5 minutes later, Moscow's walking back, and all of a sudden he showed Brad the trick. And now everybody's laughing. Brad's not feeling so bad no more. It was hilarious.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, you got a lot of memories like that, you know, what you did and the fun stuff, you know.
Well, that's awesome, Scott. We want to thank you, man, for taking the time to chatting with us today, and we want to remind everybody, man, to go pick up the book Strong Style, which is at scottflashnorton.com. When is it going to be out on Amazon, or is it going to be?
It's going to be out anytime now, right?
Okay.
It's going to be out by the time this airs. It will be out.
Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah. If you're definitely want to hear some great stories and a fan of Scott, you want to definitely get this book. It's very entertaining and enlightening. So thank you, Scott Norton, again. We appreciate it.
Hey, guys, I had a blast, man. Thank you.
All righty.
Hey, everybody. Matt Michaels here. I want you all to join us at the Boulder Station Hotel and Casino on Monday, August 26th, 6 p.m., where our special guest will be Sin Bodhi. The Warlord of Weird is coming to the Kicks Lounge at Boulder Station Hotel and Casino here in Las Vegas. It is 21 years and older, and there will be a lot of weirdness happening. So please, come on, check it out, and let's see if you can get as weird as Sin.
What's up, everybody? This is your boy Simon Street with the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. Want to let everybody know that on Thursday, September 5th through Friday, September 6th at Sam's Town Hotel Gambling Casino, Impact Live Wrestling is going to be here in Vegas. Again, that's going to be on September 5th and September 6th at Sam's Town Live. We're going to be there. Hope to see you there too.
Hey everybody, this is Matt Michaels, and I'm encouraging you to check out Vampiros Lucha Fight Club, They'll be having a live event August 23rd, 24th, 25th, and 26th at the Rio Hotel and Casino right here in Las Vegas. If you're looking for some great Lucha Libre action, Vampiro's Lucha Fight Club is the place to be. We'll be there. Will you?
What's up, y'all? This is Sin City Steve. Just urging you to join us, the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting, as we are going to be at ROH, Death Before Dishonor, on September the 27th, live from Sam's Town here in Las Vegas, Nevada. Bell time is 6 p.m., and the very next night, September the 28th, there will be a live international TV taping. Again, September 27th and 28th, live at Sam's Town. Come check out Ring of Honor.
Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting.